Well, thank you all very much for coming today. And I would like to thank the Yeshiva University Medical Ethics Society for partnering in this conference, which someone asked me during the break, how do you think it's going? And I have to say, I think that it's going great and that we are touching on the very material that I hope that we would be touching on. Although I am a geneticist, much of what I'm going to be talking about during the next 20 or 25 minutes is not genetic, as you'll hear. And I'm actually going to read a series of excerpts for you from a book that I've written called Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People. It's going to be published by Oxford University Press. Oxford asked Professor Schiffman to be a reviewer, and the review came back and it was thumbs up. So I knew that I was on the right track, although it seems as though I don't quite understand our Assyrian history. So I promise you, Larry, that I'm going to work on that before the book is published. So I'm going to talk today about how do individuals count themselves and how not to get counted, because we're in an era of what I would characterize as do-it-yourself genetic testing. And it represents part of a contemporary trend in which people seem to be willing to give up their privacy, much to my personal amazement. So Albert Einstein might have been the most famous Jew of the 20th century. His biographer, Walter Isaacson, has noted, so when he arrived in New York in April 1921, he was greeted by adoring throngs as the world's first scientific celebrity, one who also happened to be a gentle icon of humanist values and a living patron saint for the Jews. Yet over the course of his lifetime, he became a committed Jew and Zionist, and eventually was offered the presidency of Israel, an offer that he declined. However, an honor that he conveyed was actually to the College of Medicine at Yeshiva University, and as you all know, it bears his name. Near the end of his life in 1955, he stated, "My relationship to the Jewish people has become my strongest tie." He explained that the root to his Jewishness, in his popular 1934 book, The World as I See It, the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, an almost fanatical love of justice, and the desire for personal independence, these are the features of the Jewish tradition which make me thank my stars that I belong to it. He went on to note, "In the philosophical sense, there is, in my opinion, no specific Jewish outlook. Judaism seems to me to be concerned almost exclusively with the moral attitude in life and to life. I look upon it as the essence of an attitude to life which is incarnate in the Jewish people rather than the essence of laws laid down in the Torah and interpreted in the Talmud." Einstein was emphatic that his Jewish identity was not religiously motivated. In your letter, he wrote to the rabbis of Berlin in 1921, who urged him to become a dues-paying member of the Jewish religious community, "I notice that the word Jew is ambiguous in that it refers, one, to nationality and origin, and two, to faith. I am a Jew in the first sense, not in the second." So Einstein highlighted several of the features that foster Jewish identity, nationality or race or group membership, the culture emanating from group membership, and the shared religious belief. And actually, in the slide, I've tried to capture some of these ideas and some of the sources of Jewish identity that that people have. So Fishberg and Jacobs, whom you've heard about, were concerned with the biological basis for Jewishness, as indeed were the Germans with the Nuremberg Law. Of course, that unfortunately led to a very unhappy time in our history with the Holocaust, which in its own way, as you'll hear, has become an important source of Jewish identity, and also anti-Semitism, which plays a role in people's Jewish identity. So, the National Jewish Population Survey of 2000 to 2001 observed most American Jewish adults observe in some way the high holidays, Passover, Hanukkah. Majorities also read a Jewish newspaper or magazine or books with Jewish content, regard being Jewish as very important, or report that half or more of their close friends are Jewish. This survey is sponsored by the philanthropic United Jewish Communities and Jewish Federations of North America in order to understand the size of the North American Jewish population and its key characteristics. The survey found that a quarter to a third of the population is very religiously and communally inclined. This inclination is manifested by lighting Sabbath candles, keeping a kosher home, attending religious services at least monthly, belonging to a Jewish community center or other Jewish organizations, making financial contributions to Jewish charities, volunteering in Jewish social service agencies, participating in Jewish adult education programs, and visiting Israel twice or more. A third to half of the population is moderately engaged in a variety of Jewish behaviors, including belonging to a synagogue as an individual or as a household, making a personal or household donation to a Jewish cause outside the Federation system, using the internet for Jewish purposes, and participating in cultural activities with Jewish content. Zionism is a feature of this American view of Jewish identity. Beyond religious and cultural observance and philanthropy, the number of visits to Israel tends to correlate with an individual's Jewish engagement. In his book, The Holocaust in American Life, Peter Novick observed these statistics but did not view them to be sufficiently compelling to provide the basis for a distinctive Jewish identity in the United States. Rather, he observed that the Holocaust, the extermination of 6 million Jews by the Nazis and their sympathizers, is a major unifying force. In his words, what American Jews do have in common is the knowledge that but for their parents, or more often grandparents or great-grandparents' immigration, they would have suffered the fate of European Jewry. With an increasingly diverse and divided American Jewry, this has become the historical foundation of the endlessly repeated but historically dubious slogan, "We are one." Novick noted that many Jewish commentators have warned that a Holocaust-centered Judaism would not work to ensure Jewish survival, that it would be a turnoff alienating the young. In practice, it has not worked out that way because American culture has embraced the Holocaust as a universal example of evil in the world. As a result, over the past 40 years, the Holocaust has come to represent an American memory, not just a Jewish memory. The Holocaust is, as Novick has noted, an antidote for innocence. Teaching of the Holocaust in the public schools has been legislatively mandated in a number of states. The 1994 New York law cited the following. The legislature finds, recognizes, and affirms the importance of people's learning to appreciate the sanctity of life and the dignity of the individuals. Pupils must develop the following, a respect for each person as a unique individual, and understand the importance of a universal concern for ethics and human rights. Therefore, the legislature recognizes the importance of teaching our youth ethical and moral behavior specifically related to human rights violations, genocide issues, and slavery, as well as the Holocaust. Thus, in a curious turn of events, remembrance of the Holocaust has become a pro-Semitic rather than anti-Semitic experience. It is also a safeguard against the kind of assimilation of Einstein's European contemporaries, who often felt more German or French than Jewish, only to discover that their European neighbors did not share their views. Hélène Burr, a young French woman who died in the Holocaust, kept a diary that survived. Her journal entry of December 31, 1943, typified the assimilation that she experienced. When I write the word Jew, I am not saying exactly what I mean, because for me, that distinction does not exist. I do not feel different from other people. I will never think of myself as a separate human group, and perhaps that is why I suffer so much, because I don't understand it at all. During Einstein's era, anti-Semitism was common in the United States and its own cohesive force among Jews. Jews were excluded from universities, clubs, and professions. Sometimes this anti-Semitism was the official policy of the United States government, is typified by the refusal to accept large numbers of European Jewish immigrants at the Evian Conference on Jewish immigration from Nazi-occupied countries in 1938, or by the refusal to bomb the rail lines to Auschwitz in 1945 to prevent Jews from being transported to the death camp. Sometimes this anti-Semitism was part of everyday social contact, such as that described in the popular novel and subsequent movie, Gentleman's Agreement. In this story, the widowed Gentile journalist, Philip Schuyler Green, adopted a Jewish identity as Phil Green in order to write about firsthand experiences with anti-Semitism. The bigotry that he experienced was sometimes subtle, other times more overt. Both Phil and his son Tommy readily encountered anti-Semitic remarks, with Tommy being called a dirty Jew by his schoolmates. The anti-Semitism of Phil's fiancée, Kathy Lacey, and her social set in Darien, Connecticut, was the major source of conflict in the book, such as the decision of some of Kathy's friends to boycott the party celebrating her engagement to a Jew. This pervasive anti-Semitism in everyday life was not merely the stuff of fiction. Malcolm Gladwell described it in Outliers, how some of the Jewish super lawyers of today were not hired by the white shoe law firms of the 1950s because they were not like us. The direct personal experience of anti-Semitism and the recall of stories such as Phil Green's were bonding for Jews in the United States in the mid-20th century and even earlier. Sometimes anti-Semitism worked to the advantage of American Jews. In Outliers, Gladwell added the new element of Jewish opportunities to the mix of Jewish genes, Jewish mothers, and Jewish schools, and I guess Carl Skorecki would say Jewish methylation. In his chapter on Powerhouse New York Jewish Lawyers, Gladwell made the point that all were born around 1930. As a result, they came to age during a Depression era demographic drought. When fewer kids in schools got time from teachers, they went on to good colleges and good law schools. When they graduated, for the most part, they were kept out of New York City white shoe WASP law firms because of the anti-Semitic snobbery of the 1950s. As a result, they started their own law firms. These became the powerhouse firms of today because the lawyers turned to areas of the law like stock proxy fights and hostile takeover bids that were unglamorous in the 1950s, but extremely remunerative in the 1970s and 80s. So their accidents of birth and standing as young lawyers gave them the greatest of opportunities. In a subchapter of Outliers, Gladwell called their accidents of birth and standing the importance of being Jewish, but times have changed. The writers of the American Jewish Yearbook of 2007 noted, the American Jewish community in the United States, the largest concentration of Jews in the world outside Israel, experienced relatively low levels of expression of anti-Semitic expression, both behavioral and attitudinal, in 2006. This followed a 50-year pattern that reflected the strengths of a pluralistic society, even as intergroup tensions in general continued to concern political leaders and social analysts. In 1984, Charles Silverman documented this transition from an anti-Semitic age in his influential book, A Certain People, American Jews and Their Lives Today. His message was reassuring that American Jews had successfully weathered both anti-Semitism and assimilation and retained their Jewishness. Through research and anecdotes, Silverman described how Jews achieved that comfortable state in America. Silverman explained, in the past, Jews remained Jews for one of three reasons, because they believed this was what God demanded of them, because they were born into an organic community with powerful sanctions and rewards, and because anti-Semites would not permit them to become anything else. In a certain people, Silverman discarded religion and anti-Semitism as reasons for retaining Jewish identity in favor of community. He claimed none of these factors can be relied upon today. Although American Jews are keenly aware of anti-Semitism, there is no longer enough of it to hold the community together. In the process, he was claiming for American Jews the transition of a community that has reached its third generation since the time of immigration, and the pride that had come from making it within American society as a member of a small ethnic minority. Not all of the members of the Jewish community embraced Silverman's triumphalism. In his review, Arthur Hertzberg worried that the crisis still fueled the basis for Jewish identity. He feared an eventual full-blown peace in the Middle East would eliminate one of the few remaining crises that galvanized Jews' attention. In his words, successive generations of the Jewish bourgeoisie would not find other causes to engage their attention. He worried also that the pull toward assimilation with intermarriage rates hovering at 50% would outweigh the religious and cultural revival described in a certain people. Criticizing Silverman, he stated, he simply rejects out of hand the possibility that this unique hospitality makes relatively painless assimilation an even easier choice for many Jews than the choice to engage in separatist activism within the Jewish community. Another contemporary critic, Walter Goodman, took a more balanced view by pointing out, assimilation can mean a more secure identity or the loss of identity. Yet over the past generation, the loss of identity simply predicted by Hertzberg and Goodman has not materialized for contemporary Jews, as it did for Ellen Burr and her contemporaries in the 1930s and 40s. The belief that Jews constitute a religious rather than an ethnic or racial group is widespread in the United States and other Western countries. In the United States, the 1997 White House Office of Management and Budget revisions to the standards for classification of federal data on race and ethnicity that serves as the basis for the 2010 U.S. census lists white as a race for people having European, Middle Eastern, or North African ancestry, but does not include Jewish as a category. Indeed, Jewish has never been a category in the U.S. Census, yet the genetic studies might seem to refute this. In Israel, being Jewish or Arab rather than Israeli is a nationality. Israeli is a citizenship. This decision originated with the founders of Israel, who stated in Israel's Declaration of Independence that Israel would be a Jewish rather than a secular state. The Law of Return of 1950 provided the legal basis by declaring that Jewish people everywhere have the right to come to Israel. This included Jews by choice who converted to Judaism through Orthodox Reform or conservative denominations. The religious parties in the Knesset sought to define conversion as having been supervised by the Orthodox rabbinate. This created tension with American Jewish leaders who insisted that Israel could not delegitimize Reform or conservative conversions. The Jewish Ancestry Amendment of 1970 extended the right of return to the child or grandchild of a Jew, the spouse of a Jew, the spouse of a child of a Jew, and the spouse of a grandchild of a Jew. The inclusive scope of this amendment provides sanctuary in Israel to anyone who would have been persecuted under the Nazi Nuremberg Laws of 1935. Under the Law of Return, a Jew can be excluded from Israeli citizenship if he or she is engaged in an activity directed against the Jewish people or is likely to endanger public health or security of the state. Jews who have committed serious crimes or who are fugitives in other countries can be denied the right of return. The law also excludes any people who were Jewish but voluntarily changed their religion. In 1989, the Supreme Court of Israel decided that Messianic Judaism, that combines elements of Judaism and Christianity, is not the Jewish religion. So people who have become Messianic Jews are also excluded. The Law of Return does not determine Israeli citizenship. It merely allows for Jews and their eligible descendants to permanently relocate within Israel. The nationality law of 1952, however, governs how individuals can gain Israeli citizenship. By passing this law, the Israeli Knesset made a clear distinction from the right to immigrate to Israel that was provided by the law of return and the right to citizenship. The nationality law stated that citizenship is granted to people who are born in Israel to a mother or father who is an Israeli citizen, to people who are born outside Israel if their father or mother holds Israeli citizenship, to people who are born after the death of one of their Israeli parents, or to people who are born in Israel and who have never had any nationality if they apply between their 18th and 25th birthdays and have been residents of Israel for 5 consecutive years, immediately preceding the date of filing their applications. The net effect of these laws has been to increase immigration levels by expanding the base of eligible people. In the process of allowing more secular Jews and their non-Jewish spouses to immigrate, the then secular leadership of Israel sought on the one hand to encourage immigration of people sympathetic to the views of Israel as a Jewish state, and on the other hand to minimize and undermine the influence of the religious parties in Israeli politics and society. So Carl told you about this this book by Shlomo Sand, and I actually want to quote a bit from it. In his book, The Invention of the Jewish People, Shlomo Sand has pointed out the concept of a Jewish nation and nationhood derived from the verb nasheri, or to beget, is a means for establishing a political and cultural coherence. Elaborating further, he stated, but the law of return and the associated law of citizenship were direct products of an ethnic nationalist worldview designed to provide a legal concept for the concept that the state of Israel belongs to the Jews of the world. As Ben-Gurion declared at the start of the parliamentary debate on the law of return, this is not a Jewish state only because most of its inhabitants are Jews. It is a state for the Jews wherever they may be, and for any Jew who wishes to be here. The evidence for biological Jewishness, I hope we might convince you today, has become incontrovertible. The answer to Joseph Jacob's 1899 question, are Jews Jews, would seem to be an emphatic yes. A study by David Goldstein and his co-workers demonstrated that it was possible to predict full Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, and with a somewhat lesser degree of certainty, for people with 1, 2, or 3 Jewish grandparents. The Jewish HapMap project, as you heard from Gil Atzman, and the related studies that were done by Baharan Skorecki in Israel have extended these findings to people who come from virtually all other Jewish groups, each group representing a genetic cluster that can be defined as a predominant pattern of inheritance of a large number of genetic markers. The findings are based on the fact that segments of the genome tend to be shared at higher frequency among members of a particular Jewish group and at a lesser frequency among members of different Jewish groups. This degree of shared segment sharing is greater between Jews than between Jews and non-Jews. So Jewishness at a genetic level can be characterized as a tapestry, with the threads being represented as shared segments of DNA, and no single thread being required for composition of the tapestry. The genetic affiliation of any individual might be higher for a specific Jewish group rather than for the Jewish people as a whole. Thus, there is no rigorous genetic test for Jewishness, nor would the geneticists who have conducted these studies in recent generations propose that one should be created. Moreover, such a test would not replace the religious definition of who is a Jew. Yet increasingly, people are turning to direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies to find out how Jewish they are, whether they are Kohanim, whether they are related to Sophie Shapiro or Sam Cohen. Direct-to-consumer genetic testing is being replaced now by what I characterize as do-it-yourself genetic testing. Send in your saliva, have a chip run, and then analyze your own results. You can examine not only your mitochondrial and Y chromosomal DNA, but also your whole genome for segments that you share with others. If you reach a certain threshold, then you are full Jewish, a lower threshold, then half Jewish, and so forth. These services allow people to determine not only their degree of Jewishness, but also that of other people to whom they might be genetically linked. It also allows people to discover some of their health risks and those of others to whom they are linked. Now, you as a consumer can discover genetic links to your fifth cousins, potentially the links to all of the descendants of your great-great-grandparents. This seems innocent enough, but you can determine whether the family relationships that you have always known are tied by genetic links, and in the process, identify instances of non-paternity. If adopted, you can potentially learn the identity of your biological parents. And if that were not enough, you can identify others within this direct-to-consumer genealogy world who carry high-risk genes for breast and ovarian cancer, sudden cardiac death, and other disabling and potentially fatal conditions. In one public demonstration that I saw, the names of individuals who shared one of these potentially risky DNA segments was listed for the entire world to see. This breach of genetic privacy seems amazing so shortly after the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, so-called GINA, was implemented in 2008. By logging into the company's website, we saw how easy it is to share these bits of DNA that service subscribers share with one another. These genetic services represent the latest uses for DNA chips that have fueled many of the discoveries in recent years about the relatedness of human populations and the genetic basis for many common diseases. For DTC companies who use these chips to offer genetic risk profiles for restless leg syndromes and colorectal cancer, the development of a genealogy market represents a new lease on life, as their disease prediction claims have been challenged by the Government Accounting Office, Federal Trade Commission, and many others. This rebranding has been made possible by the implementation of new methods of analysis that look for sharing not only of individual markers, but also large segments of DNA across the genome. You and your cousins may share these large segments of DNA. In fact, the number of segments that you share is predictive of your degree of relatedness. But some of these segments contain the rarer but high-risk genetic mutations for breast and ovarian cancer and sudden cardiac death, not the low-risk genetic variants that have been the focus of previous DTC genetic testing company predictions. Of course, filling in the gaps for identifying the world's cousins and their various maladies requires a consumer base that is willing to trade away the secrets of their genomes. In their zeal to fill in the genealogy gaps, many consumers may be unaware of exactly what they are disclosing. Not only are they trading the secrets of hidden bastardy and sudden cardiac death for themselves, but also their nearest relatives. Their birth parents, such as the young observant woman who kept the pregnancy secret and put the baby up for adoption, could now be outed. So too could the unknowing 25-year-old woman who discovered not only her lost fifth cousin, but also his unexpected high-risk DNA segment for sudden cardiac death. So enhanced government regulation of genetic testing represents one means for limiting who can disclose what to whom. But I would argue that the forward-thinking genealogists have the potential for taking control into their own hands by improving the rules of consent and disclosure. In the process, they may want to develop community rather than corporate DNA databanks where they formulate and enforce the rules of consent and disclosure. So accurate and precise genetic analysis is here to stay. Now is the time to assure that this genetic testing remains benevolent and does not become malevolent. Thank you all very much for listening.